Good afternoon. It is right in the middle of your work week, Wednesday, October the 24th, 2018. 17 minutes past the hour, you're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride today. Now, today is one of those days, wherever you happen to be listening to the radio, whether it's on a radio or a listening device, just take the knob off. Pull over to the side of the road, because the next 2 hours are going to be tremendous. You rarely get a show with two amazing guests like these. Very quickly, I'm going to tell you, coming up next hour, we're going to be joined by the gentleman who has won more Emmys, 7 to be exact, than anybody else in the history of the Emmy Awards. Do you know who that is? You probably know him best as Lou Grant on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Lou Grant, which is also rerunning in a lot of places. Ed Asner next hour, a good friend of this program, always fun to visit with Ed, and he'll be along next hour, and certainly a lot to talk about with everything going on in the news this morning. But this hour, we've got a guest who is equally as fun. He is the king of radio DJs, doing this for more than a half century and doing it better than anybody has ever done it. Along the way, he introduced the Beatles, probably the most iconic group in music history, at Shea Stadium in 1965. What a time we're going to have this hour talking with the legendary Cousin Brucey. Before we go to Cousin Brucey, though, we just have to hear a little bit of the theme song. We're going to ask him how this came about, what a song it is. Here we go.
Go, 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 go.
Can't you hear that drummer man now, baby?
Baby.
Don't you wanna clap your hands now, baby?
Come on, let's go, go, go. What a boogie show. Come on and go, go, go.
With Cousin Brucey.
And what a pleasure it is to be joined by the legendary Cousin Brucey. Cousin Brucey, how are you?
Well, Cousin Scott, a very good day to you. Good afternoon to you and to all the listeners. Love being with you, and I thank you so much for giving me a buzz.
Hey, it's so good to talk with you. That theme song, how did that evolve? What a great theme song it is.
Well, that was a surprise to me. That was a gift from Frankie Valli and Bob Gaudio of the Four Seasons. One day, Frankie and Bob came up to see me at the studio and handed me a 5-inch reel of recording tape. Now, I don't know, Scott, if you're old enough to remember what recording tape is, but it's this little reel of half-inch tape or quarter-inch tape, and that was brown and plastic, and that's how we used to record before digital. Now, of course, it's all numbers and algorithms and things. Today, years ago, we used to record on tape, and before that, it was wire recording, and then before that, it was paper recording. I mean, it goes back a long way. But this reel-to-reel came to me as a gift, and I've been playing it. It's been following me ever since. And here, I'm doing an interview with you, right, in your town, and your radio station, and you're using it as a flag. It was a wonderful gift.
It absolutely is. You know, it's interesting. We went from reel to reel. We went to carts, and now we're all digital. Did it change your style of broadcasting in any way?
Well, not really. As technology advances, well, we sort of advance with it, but we make sure, as performers, that we keep, you know, the good old style, the good old feeling, the warmth that we have with our listeners and the listeners have with us. We can't let technology ever take the lead. Technology must stay as our assistant. Robots must stay as our assistant. We can't let them take the lead. If that ever happens, we're going to lose the humanity in what we do and the warmth with our listeners. That can't happen.
What do you make of the reports that we keep seeing that people have a shorter attention span? Do you think that's true?
Well, I don't think they have a shorter attention span as such. I think we're just busier. You're busier, I'm busier, the listeners are all busier, so maybe that can equal shorter listening or shorter attention span. But I don't think it's shorter, I think it's more acute, and I just think we're so busy in this digital world of ours that we have less time to just sit around on a couch and really pay attention.
How did you fall into the style that became Cousin Brucey?
Well, that was an evolving thing. That was an evolutionary thing. When I first started on radio, I was a producer, and then I got my break and I went on the air. And in those days, this was the 50s, there was a guy named Alan Freed, and I'm sure you know that name because anything in Ohio, you know the name of that. That's the man who was really the grandfather and father of contemporary radio. He really invented it. And he was really the very first guy that had this energy, this wonderful beat and feeling that sounded like the music he was playing, this new thing that was evolving called rock and roll, which our critics said would not last more than 6 months. Well, we are today in its 50-plus year celebrating what we call rock and roll, and it's really become part of our DNA, because we had a lot of people that did not like it in the early days. Well, nobody ever likes a change. When the baton is ready to be handed to the next athlete, people say, oh, he was so good, why is he handing the baton over? So suddenly rock and roll was evolving and was taking over not over young people, but also the adult world was starting to say, hey, this is not so bad. Because in the beginning, they were telling you it would be a sin to listen to a guy like Cousin Brucey or Alan Freed. It's the devil's music. But of course, that was ridiculous. What it is change. Very few people can handle change. But after a while, people accept it. If it's palatable, and if it feels good with your diet, it's okay. So my Cousin Brucey thing started in Bermuda. Scott, I'll tell you a quick thing about that. My very first job, I graduated New York University, where I founded the radio station, which was really still one of my great feathers and prides. And I went, my first job, when I sent out, in those days we had to send out demo tapes on these little reel-to-reel before CDs and digital. And I sent out about 7 of them while I was in college at New York University. That was part of the course that we were teaching. And by the way, I founded the radio station while I was at NYU. And out of the 7 demo tapes, Scott, 6 of them came back and told me to go in my father's business. One, though, said they thought I had some kind of a talent, and they invited me. And that invitation came from the nation of Bermuda. Bermuda. And I spent a year there, and they thought I had some sort of talent, and I developed that talent while I was there. It was probably one of the most exciting experiences of my life at that time, anyhow. And I was away from home for the first time and in a foreign country, which was not so foreign, and I had a wonderful time. I learned my trade. I learned my skills.
What was so exciting about Bermuda?
Say again?
I said, what was so exciting about Bermuda?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm having a little trouble, but we're fine. I'm getting you. Well, you were away. Look, first of all, I was away from home. I've never been away from home. Then, of course, I went into the Army. But up to that time, I was never really away from Mom and Dad. So I was under their protection, under their blankets. But here I was on my own, meeting different people, albeit a foreign nation, which is really not that foreign. It's British origins, of course, and it's only like 90 miles or so off the coast of North Carolina. But it was foreign, and it was different. It was an adventure for this 18 or 19-year-old kid that never had any kind of experience at all. So it was a wonderful time. And Bermuda was just, it offered me a chance to develop. A chance to develop the skills and become future Cousin Brucey. In fact, I'll tell you something funny, Scott. You'll get a kick out of it. While I was in Bermuda, I was one of the first people that brought rock and roll over to that very quiet Placid Island. And every year, every day, I go on the air on ZBM or ZBM, and I do a show called The Search Party. And on The Search Party, I mix local Calypsonians with a new thing called rock and roll. And then rock and roll eventually took over all of them, all the music. And I developed this skill there, and the hammer was born. Now, they called me the hammer because they never heard anybody talk with the sound of this music. The music has a great energy and a cacophony and a sound that really is wonderful. I mean, it makes you feel good. So that's what I did on the air. I developed this skill, and I also learned from my mentor, Alan Freed, as I said, who was the granddaddy and daddy of rock and roll radio. So I practiced this skill, I honed the skill, and here we are today.
Mm. Who gave you the moniker Cousin Brucey?
Oh, that's kind of a fun story. I was in the studio. I was at WINS. My name is Bruce Morrow, albeit most people think my last name is Brucey, because that's what they call me, Cousin Brucey. So it's Bruce Morrow on the air at WINS. And one night, a little old lady was escorted into the studio, this little booth that we had that I was playing records on, and transcriptions. Now, a lot of the audience might not remember what those things are. It's that black shellac with a little hole in the middle, and I'd play, be playing records and queuing them up, and the guard came in and said, Mr. Morrow, Bruce, would you, it was before Cousin Brucey, would you mind seeing this lady? She'd like to talk to you. And I said, sure, I'll be very happy to see you. In those days, we'd invite people into the studios. We weren't afraid that some wacko would be coming in and try to take over the radio station. Oh, you know, there was no security issue. So she came in and she looked me in the eyes. Now, she had this, she was gray-haired and had this beautiful sparkle in her eyes. And she looked me directly in the eyes. Now, Scott, as you know, if somebody looks you, when they speak to you, and everyone should know this, always look somebody directly in the eyes. You capture them. It's like a magnet. So this little old lady said to me, excuse me, Mr. Morrow, do you believe we're all related? And I looked at her, and I said, yes. And I excused myself for a moment. I had to queue up a record, and I started a record on the air, which gave me about 2.5 minutes to talk to her. And she said, well, you believe we're all related. She said, quote, cousin, lend me 50 cents to get home, I'm broke. And I played the record, and I gave her the 50 cents. This is exactly what happened, Scott. This is one of those things that come from up above, I guess, because we're all looking for some kind of shtick, some kind of a thing to hang our hat on. And she said, well, cousin, thank you so much, and she left. She wasn't interested in my music or really me. She needed 50 cents. She was broke. So she left. And on the way home, I lived in Brooklyn, New York in those days. You go through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. And in the middle of the tunnel, a bell started ringing, and I saw a light. Right? I wasn't hallucinating. I wasn't on anything, no dessert. I was going through the tunnel, and asleep. I had this great insight. Cousin, lend me 50 cents. Cousin Brucey. Cousin Bruce Morrow was born in the middle of the tunnel, going from Manhattan to Brooklyn, New York. It's like, I swear, if I go to that tunnel once in a while to go do an appearance in Brooklyn, and I see a rose growing from the place that it happened. That's kind of silly, but that's exactly what happened. Now, the postscript, Scott, would you like to hear it?
I would.
All right. Here's the postscript. That little old lady never paid me back that 50 cents that she borrowed. However, I'll never see her again. But to this day, I think I owe her a few more dollars. She gave me Cousin Brucey.
She certainly did. You know, Cousin Brucey, it's interesting because a lot of DJs come on and they introduce songs. But a lot of DJs become iconic because of their personality. What do you think it was about your personality that allowed you to come through radio? It's an interesting medium.
It is. Oh, it is. Well, I discovered early from watching guys like Freed and other people, Jack Lacey and people like that, that I noticed that they were not talking at, but talking to people, like you do, Scott. You know the secret. The secret is, you know, we talk through microphones and transistors and all kinds of transmitters and things, and today we're all digital. But the big secret is that people in the audience are part of the show. We never talk at them. You know, the old-fashioned radio announcers used to get on and sound, you know, very pompous and things. We have to be in their ear. We have to be in their homes. I know I'm in showers with people. I'm in the bathroom with people. I'm in cars. I go shopping with people. We're in their ears. So we have to be more of a companion than a broadcaster or an announcer talking to. talking at. We must always talk to people. These people are with us. They're part of our DNA, and we're part of their DNA. So I realized that at a very early age. That's where I really hold my skill, if you would, or talent, if you would call it. I'm just, you know, I go on the air, and I'm a friend, and I know my friends are all listening, and I get reaction from them, and they get reaction from me. So it, to me, it's very easy. I listen to stations that I travel around the country. I listen to AM and FM radio. As you know, I'm on Sirius XM satellite radio, where I developed my skill on AM and FM. And I noticed that a lot of the people, the young people today, are reading cards, doing station breaks and telling time, but not getting involved. And there's the word, Scott, involved with their audience, per se. That's the whole secret of the thing, and that's where the talent comes in. When the audience realizes that you are with them, and that you're not just a voice in this little magic box or whatever they're streaming radio today, when they realize that you're talking with them and to them, well, then you got it made. And that's what I discovered a long time ago.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think our friends that are listening right now, this is live. And I think this is the best way to go. I don't know what I'm going to say. You don't know. I don't know what you're going to say.
No.
And if
no.
something happens, it happens, and we go along.
Exactly. Well, that's how I do my shows. I insist on my shows today are all live, except one on Sunday is called The Best of Brucey. And that is like an archival collage of the shows that I've done for Sirius for the past many, many years. But any show that I do, I like live. Even when you and I talked about and discussed doing this, I asked if we were live. To me, that's important. That's where radio lies. And you're absolutely right. That's very astute. We never know what we're going to say the next moment because we're people. And people react to people, and people react to stimuli, what is going around us, whether it be religious, political, social, right? Just general things that happen at the moment, and that's how we react to it. And that's what people like to listen to. I don't think people like to listen to, you know, things that are framed, that are obviously planned and scripted. That's boring. Not in today's world. Today's world, we move very quickly, and we assimilate all kinds of information very quickly, which goes back to one of your original statements that how much can we really assimilate as the stream of consciousness, condensed today, or we have less time to think about things. I think we just move along with the flow, and that's where it's at, just like we're doing right now, which I love. I love talking like this, and that's what I do on all my shows. I never plan. I go in, and I know what I want to play because I plan my shows, but I never stick to that. Because if you ever listen to my shows, I listen to the audience. The audience calls me. I have all kinds of guests on the air, whether they be celebrities or people who are listening in everyday life, and they let me know where to go. So I cancel what I planned. And I cancel what I plan. I don't plan anything. I react to what's happening in people's lives, like you do.
You have to be able to adapt. There's
yes.
no doubt about it. When did the... Well, let me ask you this first. What is the worst mistake you ever made on the air?
Let's see. I'll tell you one. A long time ago, when I was in Bermuda, this is a funny story. It's not so funny. It wasn't funny at the time. Now I sort of giggle at it. I was on the air, and when you start as a DJ or they hire you, you have other duties, too. And one of my other duties on the air, besides doing Bruce Morrow and my search party shows, I used to monitor and tech or engineer a Sunday morning church service. And this is a terrible story. I'm giggling, but I still shiver about it. And during this church service, which was in Portuguese, which is a very difficult language, Portuguese, I used to get ready to do my other shows. So I remember I was queuing up or listening an audition so people wouldn't hear it. While the church service was live, I was getting ready to do, a dramatic show. I used to do everything there. So I was auditioning sound effects. And one of the sound effects I was auditioning was horrific sounds of fire engines and emergency vehicles. So I was a guy who was very young and not that experienced. instead of putting the key or they used to call them keys, that would open the, you know, from cue or audition to live. It might be a little tough to understand. But when you have the key or the lock in the audition circuit, it does not go on the air live. I forgot to do that, and I left the key that I was auditioning these records and sound effects, I had it on live. So while the church service was going on, I queued up this record, and I played the sound effect of emergency vehicles, sirens, you know, woo-woo. It sounded terrible. And the audience perceives it as an emergency or a disaster at the church. Well, you can imagine what happened. So I mixed this in without knowing, and I couldn't imagine what was going on. The phone started ringing. Police came up, you know, and nobody knew. They sent fire engines down there and ambulances and emergency vehicles because they thought there was a, you know, a disaster at the church. So that was probably the most embarrassing and stupid thing I've ever done on the air. Ever since that, I'll tell you, I learned quickly. I make mistakes like everyone else, but I learned quickly. I've never done anything like that again.
You know, those keys will always get you. I went in one time to the radio station on a Saturday to record an interview, and I knocked the Cleveland Indians off the air for 20 minutes.
Huh.
And I thought, well, what
yeah.
can you do?
Look, it's human error. We all, every one of us, you, me, everybody in the audience, we all make a mistake. But the whole thing is, you make a mistake, which is fine, right? As long as you learn from it. You know, Scott, I don't know if you know, but I owned many radio stations. I went into the radio management business and ownership business. And I used to teach all the young people that came to me, because I went through all this stuff, just exactly, make a mistake. It's all right to make a mistake. Never, ever be afraid to make a mistake and own up to it, long as you learn from it and don't do it again. That's very important. Mm-hmm. I learned that very early.
What are some of the other great lessons in broadcasting you've learned?
I'm sorry, I think I got you about legends in broadcasting.
Yeah, what are some of the great lessons that you've learned about how to do this business right?
Oh, all right. Well, I think we go over that. I think you learn that every single day. You know, every day that you're on the air, Scott, every day that your cousin Brucey here is on the air, it's like, well, an educational experience. I always tell people who work for me, all the younger people, and I'm surrounded by 20-year-olds now, which is kind of amazing. They have to keep up with me, and I love that. But I always tell them that every day is going to be a new experience. So just be aware of it and accept it and learn by it, all right? Adapt to it. And if we learn by every new experience every single day, we're going to have it made. But then the next day comes, and we learn something new. That's what I learned. I learned to keep on learning, and it never stops. And that's why I am so, I love what I do. My energy is tenfold as it ever was. I keep having, well, I'm like a boiler. I feel like I'm a boiler, and I keep getting pressure, and I keep wanting to go on and on. But the main thing is that I'm always aware that something new is going to happen, and I'm going to learn from it every day, which will make me better the next day.
Mm. When did you decide you wanted to be a broadcaster?
Well, all my life, Scott, I wanted to study medicine. I wanted to be a doctor. I'm going to shock you now a little bit. I'm going to tell you something. It's kind of a secret. I'm holding everybody in your audience to keeping this a secret. I was a very shy kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is almost an impossible thing to believe. When I was growing up, you know, in my preteens or my teens, I was very shy. I never wanted to stand up in front of an audience. I didn't want to stand up in front of a crowd. I wanted to just be, you know, do my work in school and be left alone. And then one day, a wonderful thing happened that changed my life. A teacher, her name was Mrs. Freilicher, who was my teacher in elementary school. I went to PS, public school, PS 206 in Brooklyn. And she thought, somehow, she recognized I had some kind of a talent. And as I said, I was very shy. So I didn't want to do anything. She came over to me, and I didn't want to stand up in the class. You know, I wanted to do my work and be left alone. So she said she wants me to take a part in the annual hygiene show. Now, the word hygiene is kind of interesting. That is really was the precursor of sex education. But in those days, we couldn't have a on the syllabus SEX. It wasn't permitted. It wasn't permitted in society. We couldn't have sex classes. So we had hygiene. Now, hygiene was wonderful. Learned a lot. Learned how to brush our teeth. Learned how to wash under our arms and keep our hair neat. That's what we learned in hygiene. That's why my generation probably is so screwed up, Scott. That's what we had, hygiene classes. Well, every year they had a hygiene play. And she convinced me somehow, I don't remember, I don't know how it happened, but to audition for a part in this hygiene play, which was held in front of the entire school at an assembly, which we had every week. And we get on stage and do our thing. So I auditioned, and Scott, lo and behold, I got the part of a cavity.
Mm.
You hear what I said?
A cavity.
I was a cavity. Because of Brucey, the cavity. So they dressed me up in a big tooth with a cavity in it. And I sang some sort of a song. You know, Mommy tells me to brush my teeth. I never brush my teeth. You know, something silly. But something happened that day to me while I was on that stage looking at the audience. Of course, I was protected with a costume of a tooth, a bad tooth, but I was able to see out. And I felt and saw the warmth of the audience, Scott. As I was talking and singing, I felt an exchange. I felt very confident, and I gained my composure, and I gained my trust with the audience. There was an exchange. And from that day on, I haven't stopped talking. In public. That's how it started, because of a hygiene play as a cavity.
Mm. Here's something that's interesting. Cousin Brucey, you have worked at WABC, WNBC, WCBS. You're on Sirius now. Started in Bermuda. What do you think has kept you employable? Were you ever nervous when you were making these changes?
Well, I evidently have... and have a product that is very valuable commercially to the owners of radio stations, to the people who have the license. But more important than that, I have evidently an affinity to an audience. The audience, the audience cannot be fooled. Audience is very, very wise, very smart. And they know right away if somebody's a phony, or somebody is welcome into their homes or their cars or wherever they're listening to our great medium, which to me is the best medium. I do a lot of television. I've done films. You know, I was in Dirty Dancing. I've had a lot of films to my credit and acting things. But there's no medium that is more personal than radio. I think it's the most important one. It's there wherever you want it. Radio can be there. I think that the audience identified with me, and I became a bridge. Cousin Brucey became a bridge between the radio station and the audience, and it was acceptable, and it was natural, and it was nothing that was planned. I didn't go to any kind of school to learn how to become a Cousin Brucey or somebody that had an ability to talk to the audience. It just happened as the years went on. And the commodity increased, and the Cousin Brucey value increased. And to this day, look at this. I never thought I'd be traveling on a satellite. And at this age, I'd still be doing what I'm doing. And I think it's better. I think I'm better now, as I have a greater understanding. I'm reaching a huge audience all over. And it just continues. But the main thing is my love for the medium, our love for this audience, and the exchange just keeps it value. And you can't buy a thing like that. You can learn it a little bit, but unless you have the natural ability and the honesty, it will never, ever continue.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Tell me about 1965 Shea Stadium and the Beatles.
Oh, probably one among the most memorable times of my life. In fact, I walk around today, Scott, and if I want to conjure up that feeling in my chest and my belly, it can be done. This was Shea Stadium. I was offered the opportunity, because I had a lot to do with the Beatles. I introduced their records first in the New York metropolitan and tri-state area. So the producer name was Sid Bernstein, offered me the opportunity to co-MC the Beatles at Shea Stadium. Now, this was probably the largest venue they had up to that time. And they came over, and I was in the dugout. They brought him in by an armored car, and they brought him right to in the infield and whisked them away. Because in the stands were 65,000-plus screaming, wild people, most of them female, young girls, you know, average age like 13, 14, up to 16 and 17. And it was wild. Scott, you could feel the electricity. Now, as I said, if I want to conjure up that feeling, this is what I meant. There was a feeling that we have a public utility called Con Edison. They supply the electricity and energy to the New York metropolitan area. They could have turned off their turbines that day because there was so much electricity, so much energy in the air from these people in that Shea Stadium stands that you felt it in your body. To this day, I can feel that energy. If you ask me about it, I can feel it. I actually can feel the physical thing that happened in your body. It just came in your body and you felt the crowd. Now, the crowd was there for one reason. It wasn't a wild crowd. It was an energetic crowd. They were there to share space with the Beatles. So picture this, though. I'm in the dugout where the Beatles were getting ready. They had some pre-warm-up bands doing their thing out there, but nobody was really paying too much attention. They were there for one reason. And John Lennon and Paul McCartney came over to me because we knew each other from previous things. They called me on my phone. I played their music for quite some time before they came over here. From Pan Am Flight 101, they landed in New York, and I was there at that thing broadcasting live. Anyway, so Lennon comes over with McCartney, and he says to me, "Cousin." He called me cousin. Instead of cousin, it was cousin, the Liverpudlian. And he said, "Is this going to be safe? Is this dangerous?" Because they felt and like nothing they've ever felt before. The energy of this crowd was almost overwhelming, and they were all nervous. The other boys were nervous, but they were sort of shy. McCartney and John Lennon came over, and they discussed this with me, and I assured them that there was no danger, that these people were there for one thing, to be with them in the same area and to share love and respect. Of course, I had my fingers crossed behind my back when I said this, because I was scared stiff, too. I had never, ever in my career felt what I was feeling that day. And I was a little nervous, a little scared. Well, here we go. Now, here's the story. We're getting ready. The other bands are finished. They introduce me. I get on stage, and I introduce Ed Sullivan. Now, Ed Sullivan, of course, remember the Toast of the Town, Scott? It was a very major CBS TV show that everybody watched on Sunday, but everybody. So anyway, Ed Sullivan is now walking up the steps. I call it the scaffold steps to the little stage we had at home base that we were going to introduce the Beatles. I was about two steps behind him. He walks up the steps, and listen to this now. Show you the energy and the nervousness. The place has gone wild. He turns around to me and he says, quote, "Cousin Brucey, is this going to be dangerous? Is this safe?" He says this to me. I look up and I look at his eyes, and he was kind of a square guy. He didn't even know who the Beatles were. That's another story how we found out. He had him on his show, but he didn't know the Beatles. I think he paid him $2,500 to be on his show the first time. So he said, "Is this going to be safe?" And I said, "I'm going to get there." I figured, you know what? This guy's such a stiff, such a square. I'm going to get him a little bit, make him nervous. And I said, "Safe, Ed? This is really amazingly dangerous, what we're going to go through." So he looks out and he says, "Dangerous?" Then he looks and says to me, "Brucey, what do we do?" And I knew I had him. And I said, "Ed, pray. Let's both pray." And he looked at me and said, "Pray?" He turned around and walked up the stairs. I introduced him. He introduces the Beatles. We're on stage together. And all hell breaks loose. It was wonderful. Now, here's a postscript to that. Are you aware that the Beatles hardly, or if ever, heard the music they were playing? Because everywhere they went, especially State Stadium, there was so much noise, the cacophony, the audio level of the audience was so high they couldn't hear. Mm. The Beatles, who sang, heard them sing "Yeah, Yeah, Yeah" to each other. After a time, they stopped singing at different venues. They couldn't hear themselves, so they would just go through the motions. But that was amazing. Now, while they were on, the police came over to me, the NYPD came over, and asked me to go with them to patrol the infield and see if we can get the kids calmed down. They had chicken wire up and barricades, and I went around with the police, and we actually unfolded kids' hands from the wire and got them to calm down. Mm. Now, another postscript, PPS, that nobody really got hurt at that Chase Stadium thing because the police were so great. And the kids were there for one reason, to have a great time. So there was no bodily damage. They did a great job that day. So you ask me my most memorable or what I remember that, there's the whole story. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
You know, Cousin Brucey, it's very interesting because there have been a lot of great performers and a lot of great groups. But to this day, I can go to a teenager's iPod, and there will be a Beatles song in their playlist. What makes them so special?
Well, they had the secret, and the secret was not to have a secret. They did their thing. They were born with working-class families. They grew up working-class. They went to regular schools, and they became, you know, boys of the street. They did things that we all do and all want to do. And they related this in their music. If you listen to their music, the music, especially the earlier music, is very simple. You hear a Beatles song one time. Please, please me, I want to hold your hand. Anna, she loves you, she loves me. And you can almost hum it immediately after hearing it one time. Now, if that happens, you can play a song, and hear it and repeat it, either mentally or sing it a little bit or hum it, you know you got something very special. Their lyrics are very simple, very easy to absorb. It got a little more complicated as time went on when they became more sociologically and worldwide involved. But that early music that caught them, you could get away from enjoying and loving the Beatles. I'll give you a fun story. Like to hear a fun story about how Beatlemania captured everybody quickly?
I would.
All right. Here, picture this now. I'm on the air. You could have been on the air. I'm on the air. And little Johnny James from the Bronx, New York, calls me. Says, "Hey, Brucey. Hey, cuz. How about playing a record for me and my girl? Her name is Susie. Play anything you want. How about something by the Everly Brothers or by Elvis or by Chuck Berry? Just dedicate it to Susie from her sweetheart, Stevie," or whatever his name was. All right. Beatlemania starts. 2 weeks when all of a sudden people were wearing their hair like the Beatles. They were dressing like the Beatles. And the most amazing thing was everybody became Anglophiles. They started talking with clipped tongue like British. You know, all of a sudden, so here, 2 weeks later, after the Beatles arrive and really capture our hearts, the same guy, Stevie Smith or Schwartz, would call me and he would say, listen to this now. "Hello? Is this Cousin Brucey? This is Prince Steve Schwartz from the Bronx, Shire. Would you mind playing a record for me and me bird? I want something by that British group called the Beatles. Maybe she loves me. All right? Thank you very much, Sir Brucey. I love you. God bless the Queen. Ta-ta." Now, that happened so many times on the phone. Suddenly, everybody was coming British. So they affected our speech. They affected the way we looked, the way we dressed, the way we wore our hair. And you could not go anywhere, Scott, without getting involved with the Beatles. Now, did anybody know 50 years or so later, this was still going to be strong, like you said, at a young person's iPhone or in his digital collection, he's going to have a Beatles record? No, nobody knew that. We didn't know that. Oh. I remember when we first got the Beatles records in, we were, you know, warm about it. It was different. But we kept thinking, well, how can this British group, a foreign group, who dared to emulate the sounds of Chuck Berry and the Everly Brothers and Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, how can they be successful? How dare they? emulate or counterfeit our rock and roll. We didn't know. Nobody was that smart.
Mm.
But then it was pretty obvious a couple weeks later. It just took over everything. You couldn't go anywhere, Scott, without A, hearing a Beatles song or seeing a likeness of the Beatles, no matter where you went. And I mean no matter where you went.
Mm. That's a great story. From somebody, Brucey, who was there when they landed, was at Shea Stadium, who interviewed them, what do you know about the Beatles that we don't know? The people.
Well, the Beatles personally?
Yeah.
Well, they were a very interesting bunch of people. They were very natural. They were very nervous. I'll tell you one thing. They were very nervous when they came over here. Very scared. I remember the great story about John Lennon, or Paul McCartney went over to John Lennon when they were flying into New York, and they were looking at the streets of New York, and McCartney supposedly said to Lennon, where's the diamonds in the street? Where's the gold? Because, you know, you have those shimmering, the sidewalks would sort of shimmer a little bit because of the makeup of concrete. He was looking for the diamonds in the street. So they came in, and all heck broke loose. That first moments at the Idlewild Airport, which is now JFK, of course, they had that makeshift press conference. And the press was, the journalists were really, well, not pro-Beatle. They were pro-parent. And in those days, rock and roll was kind of a no-no, a taboo to parents. They didn't like it. They didn't like their kids being exposed to it. So the journals, the papers, would be the same way, the magazines, because they didn't represent the kids. Nobody represented the kids except radio. We did it, right? And we weren't as strong in those days as the newspapers. So the press conference was very hostile. I remember one question, I was there, one question some rude reporter asked Ringo, why do you guys wear your hair like that? You look ridiculous. And I don't know, there was a snippy answer. They were so nervous that they were snippy at the press conference because the journalists, the press, made them a little snippy. That changed very quickly because the newspapers realized that these people could sell a lot of news, sell a lot of newsprint because they were so interesting. They were a very interesting bunch. I was with them a couple times. There's a famous picture that I'm with them broadcasting. I think it was a WA Beatles C, as we used to call it. And there's a picture of them all looking at me while I'm holding my microphone, asking John or Paul or I don't know if you are familiar with that picture, but you can see that picture on the web, on the internet. Just like Cousin Brucey and the Beatles, and you'll see. That was one of the experiences. And here was a picture of all four of them looking at me, concentrating at one time. Now, according to their biographer and their personal photographer, that has never happened. They never were able to concentrate on one thing at one time. So we're always carrying on, wising off, you know, having. They were young kids, they were young guys, and they were having a good time. They never really took it very seriously. And by the way, they were very nervous. When they came to the United States, they were very scared. Because with all their success and wildness over in Europe, nothing ever replicated what they were going to go through here.
Mm. There's a few questions I want to get in here, so I just want to alert the engineer that we're going to go over a little bit here with Cousin Brucey, because I want to make sure we get these in. Tell me about the day John Lennon died, being on the air the first time after.
Well, you know, there are certain days, Scott, that you live through that you will always remember in this crazy quilt of life that we call life. And John Lennon's death was one of them. And I'll never forget where I was. You know, I was on JFK. JFK's assassination was another. But John Lennon was especially, because I knew him. I knew him as a person. I really loved John. I thought he was very special. And he was a nice guy. And he was a fun guy. He was a character. I was, my wife and I, Jody, we were in Essex, Connecticut, at a B&B, at a bed and breakfast. That was our hobby in those days. And about 6 in the morning, this was murdered the night before. I had no idea because I was, number one, I did not listen to the radio. I didn't see any newspapers. We were, you know, on a little mini vacation. So at 6 in the morning, I get a call from NBC, and then the phone starts backing up. The person down at the desk says you're getting a lot of calls. ABC was calling, CBS, all the networks. Somehow, you know, when journalists, as you know, people like yourself, when you work with somebody, you have the wherewithal to do it. You know how to find somebody. Well, here I was in this little town of Essex, Connecticut, only in the coast of Connecticut somewhere, and NBC and CBS and ABC found me. And he was the first conversation with NBC. They said to me, Cousin Brucey, what do you think of the situation with the assassination and the murder of John Lennon? And I just, they woke me up. It was 6 in the morning, Scott. 6 in the morning. I had cobwebs. I couldn't get my eyes open. And I said, what, you know, in a super, a sleep stupor, what'd you say? He said, "What? John Lennon was murdered last night. What do you think? Can you give us some comment?" And I said, my throat got clogged up. It stopped. And I said, you're going to have to call me back. I got to swallow this. I have to figure it out. I was shocked. And then 10 minutes later, they all called back, and I started talking to all the networks. And by that time, I made some calls, and I found out what had happened. I was decimated. I was blown away. I felt so terrible. A wasted life, this great poet, and a good man. He was a good man. You know, he had his moments. He was not an angel, but he had his moments. But he was a sweet guy, and he was dedicated. He cared about, he loved the audience, and he cared about people. He cared about society. And here, some wacko goes and murders him for no apparent reason except some kind of he said devils or something, but I don't remember anymore. But it was very sad. And in the days and weeks that followed that, I did many television appearances and radio interviews, and we talked about John Lennon, just like we're talking about right now. That was a waste, a horrible, but part of this is that crazy quilt of life. One never knows what's going to happen.
That
and
is.
I guess in a way, it makes it kind of interesting. That's macabre, all right, that kind of thing, but there's some pretty good things happening in life. It's not all bad. We have some golden moments. Scott, I like to call it golden moments, albeit I wish we had some more.
I agree with you. Just a quick take. In the early 80s, we had the Howard Sterns, the Don Imuses, and it seemed like every station had a zoo program there for a while, a morning zoo. What did you make of that type of broadcasting?
I did not like that. I still don't care for... you know, dirt. I don't care for the gossipy thing. I don't care for semi or pseudo-pornography on the air. I think we as an audience, people, have enough garbage in our streets. We live through it today. We have horrible racial problems, terrible political problems, right? And we don't need people laughing and having a good time at the expense of our myriad of troubles that we have going through life. So when these zoos came on, it offended me. I was not one of their listeners, and I still will not do that. I don't like it. I don't think it's funny. I don't need people telling me the nightmare, the Hieronymus Bosch, the Garden of Earthly Delights. I don't need that. I know about that. So I don't need people rubbing that in. It was, but to me, radio should be an escape. It should be an information medium. It should be a fun medium. It should be an entertainment medium. But it should not bring the garbage out. I don't think we need that. I think we're all aware of the garbage, and we don't need this kind of stuff on the air. I don't like it to this day. I realize it does very well. There are a lot of people, especially younger demographics, will think it's funny. But like I'll tell you, it ain't. It ain't funny.
Very, very well said. Cousin Brucey, 10,000 years from now, how do you want people to look back at your career?
10,000 years?
10,000.
Well, I should probably have just retired. That's funny. But people say to me, he's still alive? Or he's still doing it? Are you kidding? I have so much energy and so much knowledge of what I'm doing. I love it. People look back. I just hope somebody to think about, this guy was a pretty good guy. He was fun to listen to, and he gave everybody a good shake. Gave everybody a chance.
Well,
and he played great music. He was a hell of a guy who played music.
I can echo that. I'm glad you're still alive. I'm glad you're still doing it. And what a pleasure it has been to have you on today, because you are one of the greats in this business.
Well, thank you. Scott, a pleasure being with you, and to the audience out there. Keep listening to shows like Scott's, and give me a listen once in a while. We'll both make you happy.
Hey, stay well, Cousin Brucey.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're coming back with Ed Asner in about 10 minutes.
Or on Tuesday, November 6th.